You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Julie Marty Pearson. And we talk about a series of events that took place in her life that put her in a spot to really think about what she wanted her life to look like. And then what she did after she found herself asking that question. If I was to oversimplify all of the things in this story in order to put it into one category, I might have to choose career change. But this is so much more than that. As I was thinking about the interview, about our conversation, about the threads that went through it, and all of these events for Julie, what might tie it together is the concept of identity and purpose. When something happens in our life and we question, what does this mean about me? What does it mean about who I am and what others see me? And then taking the time to ask, on purpose, who do I want to be? Or as I think it might show up in my mind, okay, what now? We also talk about pets. Julie loves pets, and you'll hear about that. So are you ready? Of course you're ready. You're ready. You're ready. All right, let's do it. Julie Marty Pearson, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat today?
I am so ready. Thank you for having me, Amy.
Oh, yay. Thank you. All right. So I start all of my conversations asking my guests what part of the world they call home. So tell us where you are today.
I am coming to you from central, southern, very sunny and hot California.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yes. I live in Bakersfield, which for those of you that don't know, it is about 2 hours north of Los Angeles. We are in a valley surrounded by lots of agriculture and oil fields.
I think that's where the carrots come from, right? You guys are the...
Yep.
That's where my carrots come from.
We have a lot of carrots, potatoes, nuts. The Valley of California does a huge percentage of the world's nut growing. So I grew up here. I live here with my husband. And someday I'll live somewhere slightly cooler. But for now, it is still home.
Love it. I love it. I love it. We drove through on a family road trip and I was like, look, carrots, look, other food. I'm an excellent road trip guest, as you can imagine. Okay, so in a second, we're going to start the official interview, which is not how charming I am on long road trips. But I have one more question, which is what is the last compliment or kindness that you gave someone in your life, even if it was something small earlier today?
You know, it was actually yesterday. I got to go to my nephew's music concert, and the person who leads this special summer academy in this one of the school districts here was actually my junior high school band director and teacher. And so I got to see him and say hi, and I posted the picture we took and talked about how important music is in education and how music teachers need to know that they're making a difference in kids' lives every single day.
Beautiful. That is super fun. So you really, like, you grew up in this town and you're still connected to family in that town. Wow. I love it.
Yeah,
I love
I'm third generation on my mom's side, born and raised here.
Yeah, you've got deep roots in this town. That's fantastic. All right. So we're going to get to the topic of the day. So I usually try and get my guests to pinpoint a single event, a single choice of change or a transition in their life to tell a story about. But you presented something that I'm going to call a waterfall or a cascade of challenging situations that eventually led you to, and these are your words, being forced to evaluate your life, your career, and choose what you wanted the rest of your life to look like. So that's what we're going to talk about today. In sequence, you start your story with a diagnosis of kidney disease, death of your father, losing a job, a hysterectomy, and then COVID lockdown. That's a lot to happen to a person. And it's also a lot to cover in one interview, but I am up for it. I'm game if you're willing to try. So shall
we do it?
Absolutely. All right. I want to start by backing up before this cascade of events kind of happened, just to get like a benchmark, like what was your life like kind of thing. So when I think that based on the information you gave me, this all sort of started to happen shortly. It was sort of around your 40th birthday. So let's go back a little further, maybe around you were around 35 years old. Tell us a little bit about what your life was like. Did you feel content and successful? Like, what were the things that were going on then, and how did it feel?
Yeah, no, that's actually kind of perfect timing to start the story. So at 35, I had kind of achieved a lot of what I wanted to do. I had gotten my doctorate in organizational psychology. I was working in administrative positions in higher education. I worked in various colleges and universities all over California. And I loved what I was doing. It was my goal to have these type of positions where I was involved in what we call accreditation, which is very important for schools to go through because that's basically what makes them legal and able to give degrees to their students. So, as you can imagine, it's a very important job. It's also a very stressful job. But also moving up in higher ed usually means you have to move to a new school or university because there's not a lot of upward mo movement available at the same school. So a lot of us who work in this area, whether you're professors or teachers or staff or whatever, often move around. So that's kind of where I was at 35, going from one experience to the next. And from 35 to 40, a lot of it was me commuting. I actually worked in places that were anywhere from 2 to 5 hours away from where I lived. My husband and I have a home that we own in Bakersfield, and there are universities here, but I had worked for them, and there were only certain positions available in certain places. So at times, I was commuting 2 hours away, 4.5, 5 hours away. So a lot of those were basically me living out of a suitcase. I lived where the school was during the week, and I came home on the weekends. And it was, kind of this roller coaster of always the net, I never really had time to breathe. I always felt like when I was there, I was working and I was in it, and then I'd be home, but then I had to do laundry and where am I going? What's next? So, I was achieving what I wanted. And I did enjoy the work I did, but that 35 to 40 was exhausting physically and mentally.
Did you know
And
that then? Were you aware of
I
how
did,
intense?
and it was things I consciously talked about because I've had autoimmune issues since I was a kid. So I've always had to listen to my body. And so that's why I didn't try to commute every day to some of the places. So, like, there was one in LA, which was only about 1.5, 2 hours from my house, but I knew I couldn't do it every day. So I actually paid to have an apartment on campus so I could have the apartment during the week, which was really nice because I could walk to work, I could walk to back to the apartment for lunch. So there was aspects of that that were good and were healthy for me to be able to walk and exercise and all of that. But the living out of a suitcase and never really feeling like I was settled or get to be home enough to enjoy it. And my dad wasn't getting any younger. My parent One of the reasons my husband and I are here and never moved for my job was because, one, it's a fairly low cost of living compared to the rest of California, and we were able to get into a home at a point where it was a pretty low price compared to now. And so we knew it didn't make sense for us to pick up every time I got a new job. And my husband's a carpenter, which is also a very difficult thing to find a consistent work in. His parents are here too, so there were a lot of reasons why I did it. But I also knew I couldn't do it forever. Like, I knew my body wouldn't survive. So I tried to choose options that were better for me in terms of where it was and the work I was doing and stuff like that. Now, not everything always worked out the way I thought it would, but I was doing what I wanted to do, what I was good at, what I loved, what I had been working towards. But, I was also learning what I really wanted and what I didn't want. And anyone who's worked in any kind of education knows there's a lot of politics. There's a lot of, fighting within the school, fighting without outside the school. You're dealing with a lot of budget things and funding and all these things that make it an added level of stress, especially for the kind of work that I was doing. So it wasn't easy, but
But
I was doing it.
you were happy with the job. It was the job that you had trained for and that you wanted. You'd gone to a lot of school. How did that turn up in like your social and hobbies? Like, were you, if we had run into each other when you were like 35 or 36, and I had said like, "Hey, how are things going?" Would you have said, "Oh, great. I'm like happy. Like things are good."
Yes and no. I would say professionally, yes, I was happy, but personally, yeah, I didn't have time to stay connected with a lot of friends.
Okay.
I didn't even always have time to see my family that was here because I'd be home for, 2 nights maybe. And later on I questioned, well, I didn't force myself to spend more time with them, but it's like there's only so much time we have. And it definitely showed not only in my relationships with close friends and family, but also in my marriage because my husband and I got used to not living together a lot.
Yeah.
So that definitely comes up later in my story because, when you get used to your own space and then you come back to it, like we would get really irritated at each other over little things, but it was because he was used to his routine with me gone and I was used to my own space and routine that he was never a part of. So it definitely impacted my personal life more than it did my professional, for sure.
All right, very good. Okay, so that's 35 to 40, grinding away on what is like really the traditional path. Go to school, get a job that you want, get married, try to get promoted and make the most of the job. You know, that's the traditional path. So you get sick. You are diagnosed with kidney disease. I'm going to admit that I don't actually know very much about kidney disease. It's not, I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I'm okay with admitting that. But how did you find out about this? Like, what was sort of the backstory? Is it something that, you know, goes on and on? Is there a treatment? Is it something you still deal with? Tell us what that was about.
So yes, I still have it. I'm considered to have chronic kidney disease, which means the kidney issues are still there. I have stabilized over the last 5 years, but that's still something I write down if people say, "What issues do you have?" So what happened was I turned 40 and I was pretty exhausted because I'm an August birthday, and that summer I had traveled a lot for work. I'd gone to two conferences, it was a lot. And I even had a trip planned with one of my friends, and then she broke her leg or something, and we didn't end up going. So I was really disappointed in how my 40th was going. All these things were kind of happening. And I remember about 2 weeks after I got a call from my doctor, my rheumatologist, who I saw regularly, so he did regular blood work, and they said, "Have you been sick? Are you feeling okay?" And I'm like, "I mean, I guess like normal for me." And they're like, "Well, your kidney function is very low. It had gone down to about 25% function." And they're like, "This has never showed up for you before. We're concerned. We want to send you to a kidney doctor." I'm like, "Okay." So I was sent to a nephrologist who did more tests. And he said, "Yeah, this isn't just a one-off. Something is going on because there were more issues." And I won't get into all the technical stuff, but I went through a lot of things. I had to stop working. I had to take a leave. I had to go through a lot of testing, a lot of medication changes. They ultimately did a kidney biopsy, and it showed that, I don't know how they know this, but that it was caused by medications I'd been taking.
Okay.
So, because I've had autoimmune issues since I was a kid, I had Epstein-Barr at 12. I missed most of my 7th grade year because of it, which means my body activated a lot of my genetic autoimmune stuff in puberty, where that usually happens for women when they have kids or into menopause. So I was lucky. I got it early. And so one of the things I took a lot of is Advil. I took Advil
Okay.
every single day. I had a lot of pain in various places, including my mouth. I have a disorder called Sjogren's syndrome that causes you to not have your normal glands work properly. Salivation, tears in your eye. Basically, my body attacks those glands, and so they don't work right. So I have very severe dry mouth. I have very severe dry eye, and my teeth started falling apart because of it. So I was taking like Motrin 800 pills every day. Well, I had no idea that slowly it was also hurting my body. But I was in the pain, and that's all that I needed to deal with. So basically, since then, I'm not allowed to take any type of ibuprofen or Advil anymore. We were able to do a lot of medication shifts and changes. I learned about kidney disease and what is good for my body and what isn't in terms of what I'm eating. So I already didn't eat much meat because it's never agreed with me. So I had to cut down on that more, low sodium, all those kind of things. So I was off work for, gosh, probably 6 weeks dealing with all of this, going through all the testing. And then we felt like, okay, we can manage it. We were able to kind of get it to start coming up. We thought this was something we could deal with. But basically, when they first looked at me, they're like, we have to figure out if we could do anything because if it goes any lower, you're going to be looking at dialysis. And I
Okay.
have friends who are social workers in that field, and I knew what that meant. And I knew that that would be my life was completely over in a lot of ways. And I was not going to let that happen. And so I had to put in the work. The doctors had to figure out a lot, but I was able to kind of come out doing better. Luckily, at the time, I was working at a graduate school that was actually a pharmacy school. So they all understood when I said, this is what's happening. They're like, okay, take the time. This is something you have to deal with. So luckily, I was at the right place when it happened because I also had all these professors I could go to. And I go, okay, they said this about this medication. What can you tell me? So I had my own little researchers in my back pockets.
That is really interesting. It's unfortunate about the Advil and the Tylenol. I grew up with parents who were not because of anything and not because they knew that they were right, but they were generally not really medicine takers. And so that was definitely the frame of mind that I started with as a kid. And then one of my roommates when I was in college was a pharmacy student. And she's the first person. There were two things so funny because so we were like regular college students and she was very, very smart. But the two things, and everybody who's like my kids make fun of me because I always pull these two things out. She was a lunatic about the fact that you can never take a pill without a full glass of water. Like she was like, never, ever, ever, ever. And like we could be at a party and she could be three sheets to the wind and she'd be like, don't take that Advil without a full glass of water. She was saying it was totally crazy. And the other thing is that she was the first person to tell me that like that the pain relievers, you had to be careful when you took that, like if you were dehydrated and stuff like that. Cause I grew up like thinking they were just innocuous and, don't worry about
Right.
it. Yeah.
And it even wasn't even that my parents pushed it or not. It
Right.
was, I was in tremendous pain as a kid. I had the most worst, I can't even describe you, the leg cramps I had because at the time I was sick, I was also in my growth spurt. So I'm 5'11 and I hit that in 7th grade. So I've been 5'11 since I was 12. So my body went through a lot in that time. And I could sleep for like 16 or 18 hours straight. They had a hard time getting me out of bed. So they did what they knew best to do to
Sure.
help me be able to function. But, even now, like my mom will mention Advil. I'm like, Mom, don't take too many. Even though you're almost 80, you still have to worry about it. Like, so I've kind
Yeah.
of become that person through experience.
They do. It is interesting because they do change the rules when you get up in age, like, where they're like, "All right, so if you were younger, we might have a different answer." But
Right.
they're like, "We'll go for this." But all right, very good. So that sounds like a tremendous amount of work and effort, and probably it was emotional and scary and stressful, and
Definitely.
all of those things. Not long after that, you lose your dad.
Correct. So I turned 40 in August. Within a couple weeks, the kidney stuff happened. I was off work for at least 6 or 8 weeks. I went back to work around November, December. And then, of course, I was off at the holidays. And so that Christmas, there was a weird sense we all had that it might be my dad's last. There, it was an unspoken thing. We all kind of felt it in my family. We got him the biggest, most beautiful live tree he ever would have loved. Like there were things we all, it was, there was something there. And realize at this time my dad was 94. So
Okay.
it
I was
he
gonna
was
say, so he was
not,
like, okay, so yeah, no,
and
we when someone's 94, it's a top of mind. It's like, all right.
right. And so, people are probably thinking numbers. So my dad was 54 when I was born.
Okay.
He had a family and they got divorced when his oldest was in high school. Years later, he met my mom, who was 22 years younger than him. But they had an amazing marriage. So many of my friends love coming to my house because of my parents and how amazing they were. So I was the youngest of two that he had with my mom. And so he was 54 when I was born. But luckily, knock on wood, I have his genetics. People had no idea how old he was. He didn't ever tell people his age, partly because of the age difference, which wasn't so accepted back then, but partly because you couldn't tell. I mean, people thought he was at least 10 to 15 years younger than he really was. And it was also a thing where we didn't talk about it. We were told not to talk about it. So I was used to that. But, at the point when he hit 90, we're like, Dad, the jig is up. We're not going to not talk about how old you are because it's amazing that you're 90 and still you. So, he was very healthy all his life. He never had any big heart attack, stroke, cancer. We were very lucky, but he had chronic pneumonia. He was in World War II and had pneumonia when he was in basic training, and it scarred his lungs and it impacted him his whole life. So in his 90s, he had congestive heart failure and he struggled with breathing. He had a breathing machine. He did all those things. But he was still fairly active and involved in our life, right? It was that last year or so where he really couldn't do much. And so obviously we knew all of that. And so that's why we all had this sense at Christmas. And he loved the holidays. He just loved all those things. So we had that. And then early January, I went back to work again. And one Friday, I got a call that they had been at the doctor, and the doctor said, "We think it's time for hospice." And we weren't, none of us were ready for that because he was such a strong fighter. We just thought he was just going to keep going. A lot of people think that. So I literally had to leave work, pack my stuff up, drive home. And that was Friday, and he was gone by Sunday, evening.
Oh,
So
that's
in
hard.
the end, it was very quick. Which was very, people say, well, it wasn't shocking. He was 94 and a half. I'm like, yeah, it was shocking because he went from sitting up, eating, functioning to being asleep and never waking up in less than 2 days. And it was jarring. And it was like we didn't have time to mentally prepare with what was happening. So I was lucky I was close enough. I got to be home. We were with him. We were with him making decisions and having the hospice come. And that Saturday night, I remember vividly him sitting in his chair with his TV tray, eating and having a cookie that he loved. And one of the things he always did would hold my hand when I said goodbye to him. And that night was a hard time for my mom because he really fought her. He started having some weird reactions to things. So she finally gave him the heavier meds they had given her, and he went to sleep and he never woke up. And unfortunately, I was the one that noticed when he stopped breathing, and I had to tell my mom that. But he passed away in the home that he loved, in the living room where he spent a lot of his time. And the few hours before that, when it started to be apparent how quickly everything was happening, many of his friends and our neighbors we had grown up with came to see him and sit with him and say things. So we were literally surrounded by love and family and friends, and he passed. And it was really hard, but I think growing up with an older dad, my mom always kind of prepared us. Like anything can happen, we don't know, which is also a hard thing to live with. I realized it kind of scared me in ways maybe I wasn't prepared for as a kid, but my mom also lost her father suddenly at 55. So she was very aware of what could happen. And then
I
she
think
married an
that,
older man. So there was a lot of layers to it, but ultimately we went through that. And so then I have to take time off work again and spend the next 2 weeks with my mom, staying at the house with her, my sister and I, making all the preparations, going through the funeral. And, death is exhausting and there's so much to do and so much paperwork on top of the emotion of what you're dealing with. So I'd already had a pretty hard emotional 6 months, turning 40, having health issues, and now this. So it was a lot. And
it is a
it's
lot.
like I knew that I didn't know what was going to happen after that because physically and emotionally, I was pretty worn out for sure.
Yeah, it is. It definitely. So I interviewed Suzanne Gabor a couple months ago, and she talked directly about grief because that's what she talks about. And one of the things that, and this is her, these are her opinions, but I think they have merit, is that, and it sounds like your mom was working towards this. It's like, one of the reasons that grief is so hard for people is that we maybe don't do quite as good a job of preparing the people around us for it, as we could, and we really, and that's probably true for a lot of things. We could be better prepared, but it is interesting that that's like, I mean, because we're all going to go through it. We're all going to go through it at some time, whether it's the family pet or a friend or a spouse or a
Yeah.
parent. You know, it's something that's going to hit all of us, and it's unavoidable. So, did you guys, what kind of support? So you had a lot of support, obviously, during the end stage with hospice and family, and you've got a good, strong community network in Bakersfield. What was the support like for the grief? Because that sometimes gets lost because it's a long process. Like, and people go
Yes.
back to work, and you know, it's this weird thing where it's like life is normal, but also it's not. And so did you have support for you in that time?
Looking back now, no, I did not have the right support for myself. I mean, I had friends who would be like, I'm here for you, and things like that, but and we were very lucky. We had a lot of people around us bringing us food and doing the things in that immediate time. We have a, we have a good support. I was very lucky. I grew up on a cul-de-sac, and everybody, we were a big family. We had, block parties, all those things. So there were a lot of people. A lot of people came from out of town for the funeral. It was great. But then you're right. Once that's over, it's kind of like everybody goes back to their normal lives, and you're sitting here with like, well, what do we do next?
Oh yeah, it's the
I
weirdest thing. I
It's
remember
the weirdest thing.
after my dad died, I was like at the grocery store or something and just absolutely befuddled how people could possibly be going to the grocery store and not experiencing the pain I was in. And obviously, right, I was aware
Right.
that it hadn't happened to any of those other people. But it's just that weird feeling. It's like, how can those people be like laughing and doing these things?
Yeah.
And at the same time, I'm telling myself, they're living some totally different life than, you know, they don't know
Right.
me. You know, it's the weirdest.
Well, and it's funny because this year in 2025, I've had so many friends lose a parent. In a 2 week span, I had three friends lose a parent. It was the weirdest thing. And it's been hard for me because a lot of me helping them and being like, I've been there, I'm supporting you, was also triggering. And I had a lot of stuff come up. I'd have
Yeah.
images in my head. So grief is hard because you never know when it's going to show up. And it may not show up when it happens. It could be a week later, it could be a year later. It's like this up and down thing that you go through that we're all living with in some way, but we don't really talk about it. And yeah, it's, and what I would get bad with was when I would tell someone who didn't know, well, oh, how old was he? Oh, he was 94. Oh, okay. Like it was okay. It
Right.
didn't matter. Oh, I literally would get so pissed off at people. I'm like, I don't care if he was 104. It's
It's
not
just as
okay.
hard.
It's still my dad. It's still my, I think the hardest part of grief for me was, I've always kind of, I'm the empath, I'm the counselor. That's my personality. That's why I went into psychology, because it's naturally who I am. But my mom relied on me a lot for her
Yeah.
grief. And there were times I would have to say to her, Mom, I know you were going through a hard time. I know you didn't expect it when it happened. I know that you've lost the love of your life, all these things. But you need to remember that I also lost my dad.
Yeah.
Like it was hard because I felt like I was having to take care of her and no one was taking care of me. And so I would say for me personally, that grief, that was the hardest part. And it still is. There's still moments where I feel like, when do I get to be the one that people worry about and take care of? Because I do worry about my mom. It was a huge life change. She had a month before I turned 40, she retired. She
Yeah.
decided that he had gotten worse enough. She wanted to be home with him and take care of him all the time, but she didn't realize how little time they had left. So it was, she had retired, her husband died, her life had completely changed in a very short period. So as someone who understands what she was going through, I was very supportive and eventually got her to go to a support group, which really helped her to
Yeah.
talk to other people, other widows, that thing. But she never really said to me, do you have support? Are you going somewhere? Are you, she was very tunnel vision with her grief. And one of the things people don't realize about grief is you kind of feel like you're in a fog. Like you keep moving, but you don't really feel like you're thinking clearly or, and I've seen it more now, seeing my friends go through it and helping them. I'm like, yeah, you feel like you don't know what to do. You don't know how to think. You can't think clearly. You're not sure what you should be doing, all these things. And then all the shoulds. I should have spent more time with them. I should have told him I love you more, all those things. So grief is really hard. And I think I had already been going through grief with my own body. Then I went through this big piece of me. And when you lose a parent, no matter how close or not you are, it still completely changes your life. And you also feel like, like who am I without the people who made me, you know?
Yeah, there are
And
people who
then
say it's when you become an adult. Like that's when you really actually become an adult, is when you lose your parents.
And I think, and then you start thinking, which for you as someone who's lost both of your parents, then it's like, well, what will it be like when my mom's gone? Then like, what will I do? Who, you know? So there, it's such a layered thing. And you know, now my sister is dealing with really, really bad health issues herself. Her autoimmune stuff didn't kick in until she had my nephew. And so she's actually homebound. And we don't know what's going to happen. It's a very complex situation. And so this year, as so many of my friends were losing parents, then I kind of revisited my grief. And I'm thinking, my mom's almost 80. My sister is in the state. Like at some point, I'm going to be the only Marty left. And I went through a really hard time with that. And so I think what the reason I share that is people never really think about anticipatory grief. And there are moments where you realize your time is limited with someone or something. We're going through it with our 16-year-old cat at the moment. And it's hard to see them struggle and be in pain, and you don't know what's going to happen. And so I talk openly about a lot of this experience because I know so many people are going through it, either watching it happen or it already has happened and they don't know what to do. And I think I've also found that podcasting is very therapeutic.
So, for anybody who doesn't know, the concept of anticipatory grief is that you're experiencing the grief as if it has already happened. And my favorite example of anticipatory grief, which is a ridiculous example, is there's a scene in the movie When Harry Met Sally, which is a rom-com from I think the 80s, and she's having like a total breakdown late at night, and she says to the other person, she's like, "And then some, I'm 40," and he's like, "Well, not now," and she's like, "Yeah, but someday," and she's having a current day meltdown about someday she will turn 40. And that's the example I give people about anticipatory grief. But it is one of the things that's so interesting, and then we'll move on because there's other things to talk about, is that it's a universal, everybody grieves differently for different things, but grief is one of the most researched, common, universal experiences in so many ways. There is support all over the place, faith-bound support, family support, community groups, peer groups, all of these things, books upon books upon books and podcasts and all of these things. And at the same time, it is stunning for most people to go through it when they go through it. And it doesn't, and then the entertaining part of it is that everybody who's gone through the modern day process of grief, which is very isolating, and you have this thing that you have to tell people who don't know you what's happening. People say ridiculous things. Like, and so then everybody has a pocket full of like ridiculous things people said to me when I was going through this situation. And I mean, and it's everybody's gonna be pushed off by slightly different thing because people come to you say with best of intentions and they say things and you're like, "I wanna punch you in the nose, go away." So,
Oh, yes.
exactly.
Because, we're in, I think that when you're grieving, even if it hasn't just happened, we're in a very raw place
Oh,
emotionally.
super raw.
And what I found is those are the places where we get triggered really easily.
Oh my
And
gosh, yeah.
I've experienced it with pets too. When I've lost a pet and people are like, oh, and they like kind of like, no, like you realize we do spend more time with our pets than most of our family members. Like they're a part of our everyday lives. They're the ones that are there for us at our lowest points. And, for, I talk a lot about anticipatory grief on my pet podcast because it's important for people to think about it. When you're dealing with a pet who's aging or having health issues, in the back of your head, you're going to have to make a decision at some point. And every day you wake up, how are you today? Like, is today the day? Like, that's a very heightened state of anxiety to be in. And we feel that same way with people sometimes when we have to make difficult decisions. But we also feel grief when we lose relationships, divorces, lose a job, which I went through after this too. So we grieve for so many different things, but it's a lot of stuff we don't talk about. Like we're not supposed to bring it up. And one of the things I really like to talk about when we talk about grief is please don't compare grief
Right, it's not a
because.
competition. Yeah, it's not a
And
competition.
it's different. There's so many layers to it. Me saying my 94-year-old father died is better or worse than when somebody else's father died at 60 or whatever. Like, no, it's about you. You just be in your own. Don't worry about the outside world. But we do that all too often. And it's like, it's not a competition. We should all just be supporting each other.
Right. It's not a competition. And actually, like, it's two totally separate things. So, like, the person who the a person or the pet or the experience and what happens that you are grieving is totally separate than the person who is grieving. They're related by the experience, but they're two separate things happening. And so, you know, you can have profound grief for a loss of a very short experience. You can have grief for things that you never actually had that you wished you had had. So, like, you know, like all kind of it's weird. It's wild. It's wild and it's layered and all these things. But we do have to move on. Okay, so you're at this point, you're underwater. You're like really like you're underwater, and then you lose your job, which is a third massive life stress. And like at this point, are you like burning sage in your house and like telling yourself that bad things happen in threes? Like I don't even know what was your mindset at this point?
So this was 2018. I, turned 40, had kidney disease, dad died, and then a month or two later, my job was like, "Look, we know you've been through a lot, but this is not working for us. We need someone that's here." And I'm like, "I get it." They were very understanding. They gave me extended time on my insurance, all these things that were very supportive, but I was also like, "Look, you've let me get through a lot of things without having to worry about money." But then it was like, "Okay, now what the hell do I do?" So yeah, but I'm an introvert, which people will say, "You're a podcaster." I'm like, yeah. Introvert means I draw my energy from being alone or being with one or two people, quiet, relaxing kind of thing. And one of the things I've always done because of my health is sleep. But unfortunately, I can then go down the rabbit hole of just sleep, just sleep. I was sleeping a lot after all of this, 10, 12 hours a day. And so then that also makes my body feel sluggish, my mind feel sluggish. So yeah, I was in a hole. I was in a hole and I didn't know what to do. And then my husband lost his job.
Oh my goodness. That's not even on my list. That's like
I
oh my
know.
goodness. Oh my
I just
goodness.
remembered that part. And we were so mad because the way it went down was awful. They had treated him awful, but he had done so much, all those things. And I remember actually saying, "I'm glad my dad isn't here because he would have gone down there and beat them over the head with his walker because of how bad it all happened." So I felt like if anything else happens, I'm going to break. Like, I can't. I don't know. So it was hard because not only all of the grief and loss, but then there was like, how are we going to pay our bills? How am I going to find insurance? There were all these logical things. So by the end of that year, my husband found a new job. I found a new job, which was kind of like one of those jobs I always thought was, this is it. This is my job now because it was such a great pay and it was only a half hour from home and all the things, right? I was miserable. I hated it there. And it showed up. I came in late a lot. I took days off a lot. It wasn't my place. It wasn't my people. And ultimately in 2019, I lost that job. And even though it didn't end as well as some of my others, I was like almost happy that they had ended it for me because I knew it wasn't where I needed to be. But logically, I couldn't say no because of the pay and the benefits and all the things. So that led me into kind of going back to my health and figuring out what can I do? Like, what do I need to change? And then I had a hysterectomy in
I that
2019. So
exactly. So, all right. So, but at this point, you're still working and searching for jobs in higher education along your
correct.
field. You have a hysterectomy. This is a personal question that you can tell me to buzz off, but did the hysterectomy throw you straight into early menopause? Like, did you end up going through like a hormone roller coaster kind of thing?
So what I know now is, and I think I trusted because my gynecologist was a woman, that she was going to be more helpful, but she wasn't. I now know, having educated myself more after the fact, that I was already in perimenopause. I had been having symptoms since I was about 34 or 35. So there wasn't a big shift with that respect because I was already there. But I will say the couple of years after, I for sure, I'm in menopause. I went through all the things, but the hysterectomy was harder on me for other reasons. I don't have human kids. We never had kids, for a couple of reasons. One, because of my job and how I had to commute, we were like, how would this even work? And two, because of my health.
Yeah.
Doctors had never told me not to have kids, but I had been told by several that we don't know how your body will react. You could be fine because you've already been through all of this, or it could make it all 10 times worse. And I
Okay.
see my sister now with immobility. She needs both hips replaced. Her hands and feet are riddled with rheumatoid arthritis. I'm like, I made the right decision for me because I could have easily ended up like that if I had kids and went through that all that physical change in my body on top of what I already had. And once I got diagnosed with kidney disease, we knew we'd made the right decision because if I'd tried to have a kid then, I could have ended up in dialysis for sure.
Yeah.
So, but I still was letting go of my reproductive system.
Yeah.
I had to sign a paper that said you are being sterilized. You know, there's little things that you go through in the process of a hysterectomy that they don't prepare you for. Like, oh yeah, okay, we just need you to sign this, and I'm re sterilization. Like what? You know, little things. And then because of my kidney disease, they had me stay overnight in the hospital. I could have been outpatient, but they wanted me to stay so that they could check my kidney levels before I left because anesthesia can impact your kidney function. And so they wanted to make sure that everything was okay before they let me go home. Well, I didn't think about it, nor did they tell me where I would be staying overnight in the hospital. So I get into my room post-op and, you know, I'm seeing my mom and my husband and everyone. And then I hear a baby cry and I realize I'm in the post-labor and delivery ward where all the
Uh-oh.
moms and the brand new babies come. So even though I didn't see them all night long, I could hear them. I could hear babies crying. I could hear families in the hallways with coming to meet the baby. And I get a little chill right now thinking about it. Like I was not f at all prepared for what I'd never been there before. I didn't have
Yeah.
kids. I had never been pregnant. And I just, you know, I've been in labor wards and visiting people who've had babies. I was there when my nephew was born in the room, but I had no idea where, you know, you're just going through the regular things. I'm having surgery. I have to do all these things. I had no idea. So that was kind of the first thing that kind of told me, oh boy, I don't think I was ready for what this is. And there was a big emotional piece for me that no matter why or when or how, when we go through something like a hysterectomy, you're losing a part of who you are as a woman. And I don't think we talk about that enough. And I've
Yeah.
realized I talk about it now because I want somebody out there going through it already that they hear it and they're like, oh, okay, I need to think about this. And it's not that it would have changed my mind because health-wise, it was exactly what I needed to do. But it was the shift emotionally, and then it was a shift physically. My body shape changed. People don't realize your uterus holds things up in your body.
Oh, I didn't. That
So
was oh, wow. I did not think about that. No, but it's true. There's, I mean, people are beginning to talk about it in different places that I hear. But you know, so we talk about like the mind-body connection in, you know, like in the coaching space, and when you talk about like dieting and things like bariatric surgery or weight loss, profound weight loss, you'll hear people say, you know, you should do counseling and talk about the identity stuff and the motivation. So you do sometimes hear the pieces, but I think you've hit on something very big that there's less of it in some places that it really could be, because like when you look back over the life of like a person, and you know, and I'm not a gender expert or any of those things, but that the concept that like these layers of our personality and how we identify and see each other, ourselves and other people, some of them are how we're treated every single day. And when you grow up in a female body in the United States of America, we are evaluated based on our breeding state at all times. Like you go to the doctor before you go to puberty, they only want to know, have you gone through puberty? From those years of when you go through puberty to like menopause, you can't do anything without people asking you about menstruation or if you're pregnant and being aggressive about it. Are you sure you're not
Yeah,
pregnant?
even when you
Yeah.
go to get an X-ray, are you
Exactly.
pregnant or could
Go
you
on
be pregnant?
a
It's like,
right, a
I
roller
just want to get my
coaster.
hand X-rayed. What is that? Like,
Yeah, a roller coaster. Like, there's nothing that happens. And then you turn like 35 or 40, and it's like, oh, could you be in menopause? It's like, listen, other things happen in me. I could just have a sinus infection. Let it go.
well, and I think it's also important, the spectrum of what perimenopause and menopause look like in each of us is so different yet similar. And what I will say about the hysterectomy is my mom had her hysterectomy at the exact same age I did. We had similar issues with bleeding and anemia and those things. She did not prepare me for what I went through either, but it was almost like she didn't know she was supposed to, or like, well, this is what we do. We suffer in silence. It's like, well, you could have said that this is how you felt, right? No, instead, she was the one that said to me, I know you've already made the decision, but I want to make sure that you don't want kids before you do this. It's like, Mom, I am 41. I have kidney disease amongst other. No, like, I realized it was hard for her to realize this was the end point of me ever possibly having children. So there's a lot of emotion in it. But, what I realized was my body changes in ways that it probably would have if I'd had kids, like the way my belly moved and, just all these little things that I would say the 6 months after that were really tough for me. I was very depressed. I gained weight very quickly. I was sleeping a ton. My brain was, there was a moment I said something. My husband looked at me and was like, are you okay? I'm like, what? He goes, I don't understand why you just said that. Like, it makes no sense that you asked me this question because you know why this is the way it doesn't work or whatever it was. And I was just like, I don't, So I realized I went through that and it was hard on my body. The first couple of weeks were okay, but then it was like my body just became exhausted. I couldn't do anything. And so that was hard enough. And I think during that time, I was dealing with a lot of the grief maybe I hadn't dealt with. And then COVID hit, and I was like, well, even if I wanted to go back to that career, I can't because now all the schools are closed.
All right, so like this is all right. This is like this really is like a cascade of stories. And when I looked at it, and I was like, oh, I could maybe pick one of these. And I was like, no, like we have to go all the way through it. All right, so I'm going to take a minute and talk directly to the audience because I'm talking to Julie today about this cascade of events that happened to her life that led to her asking herself about her own identity and what she wanted to do. And I want to invite you into the conversation. I will post a conversation question on Instagram and YouTube where you can come and join the conversation. I'll be there in the comments. Julie will pop in. Other people from the Imperfect Adulting community pop in. It's interesting. It's fun. So if you have stuff to add, please join us there. All right. So coming back to where we were in the story, a lot of things about pandemic and lockdown were really hard for like so many people. Like it was confusing, it was scary. But one interesting thing that I think we can see looking back that probably wasn't apparent at the time, like, because we were all just trying to do the best we could getting through it, is that it was actually a time where a lot of people made big shifts in their life. And there, it was like everybody was shifting. It was like being in like high school and everybody is graduating. And so it was a time where it was perfectly okay to talk about, like, okay, well, yesterday I was doing this, but that no longer exists. So now I've got to figure out something else. So it was like, it was a time when people could like do that. So you say that you were forced to evaluate your life, your career, and choose what you wanted the rest of your life to look like. And so my question here is, is there a moment where you can actually remember being like thinking that actual question, like, okay, what do I want my life to look like? And what did it feel to ask yourself that? Because it's something that, we talk about in like coaching circles and stuff like that, but I don't know that outside of that, people are ever like, here's how you do that.
Right. I think in some ways I'm uniquely prepared for it being someone who has a doctorate in psychology. Like, so I could use those words when other people may say it in a different way. But I think a lot of us during COVID saw how quickly we lost people or people were losing people. And I'd already lost enough in the last 2 years. Like, that loss and that sense of at any moment things can change. I made myself think, like, how do I want to be spending my time? Like, I don't know how much time I have left. It could be months, it could be decades, but how do I want to live? And it also made me realize how I wasn't really happy with a lot of the things I had been doing, but I had just done it because I was always the good girl. I was the good student. I did what I was supposed to. And you just do that. Like, that's what's adulting. I'm doing the right thing. I was always that girl. And then I realized I don't want to be that girl anymore because I'm not happy. And one of the things COVID allowed me to do was to be creative. Like, I hadn't had time to journal and read for fun. To do art stuff and color my hair pink and all these little things that for one reason or another I can't do that because I can't show up to work looking like that, or I don't have time to worry about coloring or painting or whatever it is. So for me, I felt like it really got me back into kind of like my childhood and things I used to really enjoy doing, but also just trying new things and being like, what am I going to do with the day? Luckily, my husband had a job because he had gotten a job at a school district as a carpenter. And even though he wasn't permanent staff yet, maintenance was considered, what was the word they called?
Essential.
Help. He was considered essential. So he was literally only home for 2 weeks and he went back to work. And eventually he was very busy because he was the guy doing all the screens and putting up all
Right,
the
making
stuff
the
for the kids to be
modifications,
able,
yeah.
right. So for me, I really had alone time because every day he went to work and I was home with our pets alone. And I got to like watch all the shows and watch movies and listen to podcasts and do all these things that I never had time to do before. And I started thinking about like, I knew at that point that higher education wasn't right for me anymore. My last job had taught me that. But then it was like, well, what is? For me, coaching therapy type work was always something I wanted to do. I had actually originally been in a doctoral program for clinical psychology and I was going to become a psychologist. But as an empath and someone who dealt with health issues, I realized that first year that I couldn't do it. I couldn't take on other people's stuff every day, all day long. But in my second program that I finished, we had a whole class on coaching and how to coach people and how to coach people to work better with others and work better in groups and all these things. So I knew I could do that in some way. And so I knew coaching was it. I just didn't really know what. So then I kind of started playing with what would that look like? What are people doing? What are friends of mine who are coaches doing? And what does that look like? So that time really allowed me to kind of think about all of that. I mean, obviously, I was lucky because I was off work. I was able to get unemployment, which was, even more than because they were giving people more than what it originally had been. So it helped us get through that first year. But then it was like a lot of like, well, let's just throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Like, did the answers come easily or was it murky and unclear? And it sounds like it was a little bit of both.
Yeah. So I knew coaching, and I originally started with career coaching because obviously it was something I knew. I could coach people on what jobs to get or how to change jobs or how to shift your career because I'd been through it enough, but I also worked in education. So I knew a lot of the different things. And I had friends who were coaches who I could go to for more of the business stuff. But at the same time, as that initial like COVID support went away, I had to start making some money. So I started dog sitting for a lot of people. Started with friends who had gotten puppies during COVID and now they
Right.
needed help. And so I did that. And then part of me thought, well, maybe it's something in animals. I've always loved animals. That's always been a passion of mine. So I would say 2020 to 2022 was kind of this, trying to try different things. I took a ton of different classes in business and coaching to see what people do and how they get clients and all of that. And there were times where I thought, well, this isn't working. No one's clicking the link. No one's signing up. This is, as someone who was a grader or a graded person, like to me, people didn't say yes meant this didn't work and no one wanted it. It was a failure. So those first couple of years were hard. And there were times I just kind of pushed it aside and did something else to make money. But ultimately, I came back to it because I knew there was something I could help people with. I just had to figure out the right way to do it. And that's when podcasting came into my life.
That is a wonderful story. So as I was writing the questions for this, a funny thing kept coming up in my mind. Have you, and I don't know if you are like a person who's like into spirituality or woo, but every once in a while, like there, if you believe in destiny or fate or manifestation, people will sometimes say things like, if you don't listen to the signs or the signals that are popping up, they get stronger. Like the first one is a little whisper, and the next one is a nudge, and the next one is a shove. And then finally, it's like a 2x4 to the head. And as I was like thinking about all the things you went through, I wondered if you ever found yourself in a spot being like, oh my gosh, like what am I supposed to be learning from this? Like, what have I done to bring this like cascade of like things into my life so quickly?
I've always been a spiritual person. I mean, I went to church and things like that, but I've always felt spirituality, no matter what your religion or path is very personal. So I've always been an introspective person. I have a very active imagination and fantasy world in my head, but it really wasn't until my dad passed that I really started noticing signs. And so it was the first time we went to the beach after he passed. He loved sitting and watching the boats go by and the birds and all of that. And there was a seagull, a lone seagull that showed up. And then every place we went that trip, there was one seagull. It would just sit there and kind of look at me or watch us. It was this weirdest thing. So seagulls became my sign from him. And throughout, ever since then, there are moments where I would see it. I remember one day I was in Starbucks sitting with a friend talking. I think we were talking about business stuff and what I was doing. And I looked up and there was this big picture behind me, this whole thing. And up in the very top corner, there were two seagulls. And I was like, so that I think the grief and loss and being more raw opened me up to see it more. And then, of course, I think I saw it more definitely during COVID and all of that. So there have been moments where it's like, I'm learning something from this, but part of what I'm learning is this is not it. And one of it was career coaching. Yes, I could help people with it. Yes, I could write your resume, but I didn't care about it. I wasn't excited to get up in the morning and talk about resumes. So when I first took a podcasting class, they kept saying, you do the podcast about what your business is. That's what it's for. Well, 6 months later, nothing happened because I didn't care about career coaching stuff. So that's when I pushed it aside and said, I'm going to start it about something I can talk about any day of the week with no preparation. And that is pets. And so I got on Zoom with friends and said, let's talk about our pets. I put out episodes that were raw, unedited, dogs barking, interruptions, and slowly people started listening. And it was like, oh, okay. And the thing that I pretty quickly realized was the interview process is a natural for me because of my experience in history and education and psychology. As an undergrad, I took courses on how to conduct focus groups, how to conduct interviews, how to do what we call qualitative assessment, which is asking people the right questions to get the right information. And that's literally what podcast hosting is. So I started finding ways that I could use the same skills I'd always had and loved, but in a different way. And then people started asking to be on my pet podcast. I was like, oh, okay. And then I started meeting all of these incredibly amazing, inspiring women like me in their 30s, 40s, and above, didn't have human kids, loved their pets, and had started volunteering, had started rescuing, had started nonprofits to help animals. And so a big part of me that I always felt didn't fit in the normal society as a woman without children and felt devalued as that, even within my own extended family. I am a unicorn to my in-laws. I was like, oh, there are more people out there like me. Like, this is something.
No, there's
And
a
so when
huge
I
number of people. Yeah. I mean, I have a bazillion children. I have a big family, but I always am like just absolutely like befuddled by the fact that we do devalue people who don't do it because it's almost half of the adult population. It's not a small
Right.
group of people. It's an enormous group of people. And it's like, well, what are we doing? You know? And one of the things
But
that I
in
think
most
is
workplaces I was in, I was usually the one lone woman that didn't have kids. And having changed jobs enough, I
I don't know
hated
that is.
that part of meeting new people and, oh, are you married? Oh, do you have kids? No. Oh, or oh, it was either I don't understand or oh, I'm so sorry you couldn't have them. Like there's these assumptions people make. And my husband gets it too. Men look at him like he is crazy. What do you mean you don't have kids?
It's
He's
a
like, and I
whole
will
thing.
say it came up a lot through the election because let me tell you, being told childless cat ladies have no value, which is
Oh, I
exactly who
forgot
I am,
about
fueled me in a way that my husband would be like, you need to calm down. I go, no, I don't.
that. But
Because
I always, that's one of those things. We talked about it with grief, but I will tell you, I tell people all the time, I'm like, never in the history of mankind has anybody probably ever calmed down when somebody said, okay, you need to calm down. Like, you should strike the entire phrase from your vocabulary, like, never say it to another human being, or don't expect it to actually work, right? Because
right.
it's like it's the opposite. It's like if you want to enrage somebody even more, tell them that they need to calm down. It's like the funniest thing. It's
I
the funniest
and one
thing.
of the things I've realized is I'll tell my husband, look, you need to let me yell about it here, then I won't yell about it out in public. I'll let me get it
I just am
out.
I am like amazed. And my theory is that I think that, so like, because, okay, so when we're kids, we all have parents because that's the biology, right? Like, there are no kids that don't have
Right.
parents, right? So then as a child, you assume that all adults
Have kids.
have kids, but that's like just not even the math. Like, it's like not even math. And so then it's always so weird. And so I have I learned very early on, never ever ask people. And then as someone who has a big family with kids, I will say I was on the other side of things. I always like to have lots of friends that didn't have kids because, and I like, they would plan fun things and I could go be child free with them. And
Right.
there were many, many times where I would be like, I mean, green with envy with my, it's like, oh, like I'm like running from a storm with like a house, a car full of kids and grandparents and like, guinea pigs, right? And like my other friend who has no kids is like, I flew to Vegas. And I was like, oh my God, that's so easy. Like I want
Well,
that,
and I think there's this, we talked about devaluing women if they don't have children or their reproductive purpose is gone. But as women, we mother in a million different ways. And one of the jobs I hold very sacred is being an auntie. And that
Yes.
is being an auntie both to children I am biologically related to, as well as children of my friends. Like, I am a proud auntie, and I'm also an auntie to many pets. And, tell Coco and Ginger the auntie loves them and I'll see them soon, which is two dogs. But I also say, tell Freddie and Hunter I love them and I'll see them soon, which are the two
Yeah.
human kids, And I also, having gone through all of this, I also am very conscious of my role as that person.
Yeah.
That not only do I get to be the quote fun person, but I'm giving them experiences that their parents can't in one way or another, right?
Absolutely.
And I think
Absolutely.
that as a culture, there are some societies and cultures that really value that because I read something one time and I don't even remember what it was, but it said that one of the reasons that women, one, live longer, and two, at a certain age, can no longer have children is because women are the holder of
Yeah.
the legacy of the stories. And after that age, they are then helping the next generation be raised. And
Yeah,
that was
that's
a
like,
very,
yeah.
for me, it was like, yeah, like I am 47 and I have no kids. But yesterday I went to my nephew's concert and it meant a lot to him, even if he didn't say it, that I was there and taking pictures and telling him good job because right now his mom couldn't physically be there, but also because I'm someone that he gets to see and knows he gets to have fun and do something different than what he does every day with his parents. And I take that job seriously, but I also know the value in what I'm providing because I had adults like that in our life. My parents had a couple that were very close to us. They never had kids because she had cancer at a young age and couldn't. And so I spent holidays with them and trips with them, and they were a pseudo aunt and uncle, but I also saw a different version of what life can be because of them. That it was okay that I wasn't being the traditional wife and mother because there are other people that do that. And so it's also important because we're showing kids everybody has a different path in life, and it
Yes.
doesn't mean you have to be married to have kids. Doesn't mean you have to stay married to have kids. It doesn't mean you have to have kids. And that, I think, is what gets me frustrated and angered when I hear certain things about, the society and children and moms is that, moms are amazing. And I am the first one to say, I will be like, when I meet
Yeah.
moms who have businesses and do 10 things on top of it, I'm like, girl, I don't know how you do it because I can barely do it. And I don't have to worry about other human beings that rely on me. So I think that podcasting has really let me step into who I really, my full self authentically. And it was something that I felt like part of me had to be hidden in different parts of my life because it wasn't as accepting or normal or whatever. And it wasn't even always other people saying that. It was me thinking, I can't talk about that because then I'm going to look weird. And that also stems from my childhood and being 5'11 at 12. And I stood out literally in a crowd of kids my age. So it's something I've dealt with a lot in my life that I've had to come to terms with. And there's still moments I have to shake myself out of it. But I know there are people out there that need to hear my story for one reason or another. And so that's kind of what keeps me in this space and keeps me sharing the things that I've experienced.
So we have shared, you have shared a ton of things that you've gone through. I want to bring it back together. We'll do the final questions in just a minute, but tell people what you're doing now and then and how you want them to follow up with you after they listen to the show.
Yeah, so I really fell in love with podcasting, and my pet podcast, The Story of My Pet, still exists, and it's become a advocacy platform because I realize a lot of the world of animal rescue and fostering and adoption is misinformation or lack of misinformation. So by me sharing my story as well as having all these guests on to share theirs, that if one dog gets adopted instead of euthanized at a shelter, or one litter of kittens gets saved because someone signs up to foster. Like, that's my purpose and that's my passion. But then I also started realizing through all of this that women, as women, we have so many stories we need to be telling. And that's when I shifted my business fully into podcasting and created Podcast Your Story, which is all about empowering more women to share their voice and their story, either as guests or hosts or both. Because a lot of women need that nudge to say, it's okay to talk about yourself. It's okay to share your experience, whether it's good or bad, because there's someone out there that needs to hear something you have to say. And so now that's what I do as my full-time job, is help other women find their place in podcasting, share their story, grow their business, whatever it is, or podcast about what they're passionate about, like I do with pets.
I love that. And that's obviously how you and I became connected through putting podcasts together. And then I was like, oh, well, come be on my show. All right. Are you ready, Julie, for the final three questions?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a set morning routine? And if so, do you want to share with us what it is?
I do. I have a morning routine. I get up and do certain things, check all the things, but I drink my coffee and eat a banana every morning. I go and spend a little time. We currently have three cats. I spend a little time with each of them. And then I come into my home office and, start the day of emails and all the things. But I really try to kind of take that space, and I really make an effort as a fur mom to multiple animals that I check with everybody in the morning. And so it may be simple. Some days I turn on music, some days I need some motivation. So I have what I call my upbeat work mix that I put on, and I start singing or dancing, and that kind of helps fuel me to get me going.
I love that. I love that. All right. Do you read or listen to books? And if so, do you want to share with us what the last thing you or the thing you're reading or listening to now is?
Well, I do have one. It's actually next to me, so I'm gonna grab it because I don't remember the topic. Storyworthy is a book that
Okay.
somebody I was on a podcast with recommended. And because a lot of what I talk about in podcasting is story based, I just started this and I've heard it's a really great book. So that is something I'm doing. I will admit I'm bad about reading. I think because I have two masters and a doctorate. So I did a
You've
lot
done
of
a lot of
reading that I
reading.
had to. So I actually enjoy TV and movies as my kind of release and downtime, but being in this space of podcasting, I do turn to books really for learning and growing in that space.
All right. No, that's totally, I split it up. Sometimes I ask people about TV. Sometimes I ask people about reading. Sometimes I ask people about music. I do it, I just make it up as I go along. All right. So, if you were to win a full free vacation, like fully paid vacation, like you win a prize, you get a 2-week vacation, and all of these things, there's no objects, but these are the choices. So, you have to pick one. Do you pick a beachy location somewhere tropical? Do you pick a mountain vacation with either skiing or mountain bikes or something like that, something rugged and camping? Do you pick an urban environment that is like a luxury hotel with culture and food and restaurants? Do you pick a cruise? Which one of those four is your choice for a free vacation?
I would say right now in my life and what I have done and haven't, it would probably be the more urban one. I love going to cities and feeling immersed in that like kind of life because it's not the life I live. I mean,
Yeah.
my where I live is busy and has plenty of traffic and things to do, but I love going to places. I've had great experience like in San Francisco and Chicago and places like that where you get to just walk and experience people in different cultures. And so yeah, definitely that would be my choice.
Urban luxury hotel,
And the
museums.
luxury hotel probably pushed it over
It pushed it over
the
the net. There
top.
you go.
You could ask anybody that knows me. I love a good hotel with good room service. Like that is, I'm all about it.
I got it. I got it. That's it. Julie Marty Pearson, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.